One of the most prominent rabbanim who lived here in who was the rabbi of Moscow was Rab Chaim Berlin. He was the son of the Netziv. Just to remind you who the Netziv was, the student of the Vilna Gaon, Rab Chaim Volozhiner, founded the Volozhiner Yeshiva in the city of Volozhiner in 1802, and the yeshiva lasted for 90 years, and it was closed in 1892. The government kept on harassing them. The last years, the government kept on harassing them to introduce more and more secular studies and to lock the base medrash at night until they, so they introduced a little bit secular studies. Until they made it so impossible. So then there was a big dispute among the rabbanim whether it's right to keep a yeshiva open if you're just going to learn 3 hours a day Gemara. The rest of the day is going to be sports and secular studies. So many rabbanim were of the opinion that it's still important. You should still have yeshiva. That's only 2-3 hours a day. And Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik with the Chafetz Chaim, who were attending this big meeting to discuss the matter, they insisted you have to close the yeshiva. So the yeshiva was closed in 1892. So the last 39 years of Volozhiner Yeshiva, the head of the yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva, was the Netziv. His name was Rabbi Berlin, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. He was married to the daughter of Rabbi Tzale Volozhiner, who was the son of Rabbi Chaim Volozhiner. No, he married the granddaughter of Rabbi Chaim Volozhiner, who was the founder of the yeshiva. And the 39 years that he was the Rosh Yeshiva, he had to do fundraising, he had to give shiur. And he was not a direct descendant of Rabbi Chaim Volozhiner. There were others who were direct descendants who tried to take away the leadership of the yeshiva from him, and he lasted through all of the attempted coups, and he was Rosh Yeshiva the last 39 years. So the last few years that the yeshiva was open, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, who had married his granddaughter, was the co-Rosh Yeshiva with him. So towards the end of his presidency of the yeshiva, he wanted his son, Rabbi Chaim Berlin, to take over the position of Rosh Yeshiva. This son, Rabbi Chaim Berlin, was a big baki, a big Talmid Chacham, and he was born in Volozhin. He grew up there, he learned in the yeshiva. And then when he was already an adult, he was married, he took the position as rabbi of Moscow. He's a big Talmid Chacham. And when his first wife passed away, then he left Moscow. He remarried, he was rabbi in another community. Then when the second wife passed away, he decided to move to Eretz Yisrael, and he spent the last few years of his life in Yerushalayim, no longer functioning as a rabbi. He was just sitting and learning and involved in chesed. But there in Yerushalayim, the head of the Ashkenazi community, the Heda Charedis, was the Ashkenazi community in Yerushalayim. So the head of the Ashkenazi community for many years was Rabbi Shmuel Salant. He died at a very old age. So after he passed away, even though Rabbi Chaim Berlin was not officially, didn't have any official capacity, but they brought all the major issues to him for decision. So when he passed away in 1915, it seems that that's when they found that she was Chaim Berlin. I don't think they had any sheiches, but Rabbi Chaim Berlin, he was a prominent Talmid Chacham who passed away in Yerushalayim. Just like in New York, Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan passed away in 1896, I think. So the Russian peddlers who lived, who had their business on the Lower East Side, put together the nickels and the dimes, and they made a yeshiva named after him. Yeshiva University was originally a combination of two different yeshivas. Yeshiva Eitz Chaim. Eitz Chaim was the name of Volozhiner Yeshiva that was founded by Litvish Balabatim, and the Russian Balabatim founded Yeshiva Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan, named after Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan. He was the big rabbi in Kovno. And then later on, the two yeshivas combined. So just like after Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan passed away, they founded a yeshiva in New York, and they named it after him. So Rabbi Chaim Berlin passed away, so they founded the yeshiva in New York, and they named it after him. So this Rabbi Chaim Berlin, he was a prominent Talmid Chacham, but he died in 1915 in Yerushalayim. He wasn't here under the communists, but the times were so difficult. It was difficult to raise children as a religious Jew, so they have a collection of letters that he sent to people. Somebody, one of his Talmidim, asked them about Shiduchim, has a choice of marrying one of two girls, which one should he marry? So he gives him guidance, and then he says, under these conditions, do like this, under those conditions, do like this. And then he says, don't try to have a big family, just try to have a son and a daughter, just to fulfill a mitzvah, peri merivya. It's so difficult to raise children that they should be observant. You'll be lucky if you have a son and a daughter who'll be observant. Don't try for more. And then he has another Talmud, tells him that he's in business, and he says about they have an issue shaking hands with women. It's not proper to shake hands with women. So he says, look, Mikra Adin, it's really permissible. It doesn't indicate any chibah. The whole thing is a chumrah. And as it is, everybody's laughing at the religious Jews that we're so, we do things so differently from everybody else. So don't give them another thing to laugh about. So shake hands with the women and don't be machmir. He lived under difficult times. And this was before the communists took over Russia. When his father appointed the list, after the first wife passed away, he moved back to Volozhin. So the father wanted to appoint him as the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin. So many of the students were rioting. They were upset. They felt that this is a bizoyan for Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. How did he compare to Rav Chaim Soloveitchik? So they were, when he would give the shiur, that he was, the reason why the father picked him, in the history books, they're not sure. So some say because he thought he was really Roy Lakach. He thought he was really such a big Talmid Chacham. And others think, no, the father knew that he wasn't as big as Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. But he knew Rav Chaim Soloveitchik is not going to do any fundraising. He's going to sit and learn with his nose in the Gemaras. And his son, Rav Chaim Berlin, was in the rabbinate in Moscow. And he knew wealthy Balabatim. He would be able to raise money for the yeshiva in a much more successful fashion than Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. But whatever the reason was, it didn't turn out.
Doesn't have any.
Because when Rav Chaim Berlin would give the public shiur in the Beis Medrash, so the Talmidim would slug up the shiur. They would ask kashas in the middle. They would humiliate him, and they would ask him so many questions that he couldn't answer. So the whole thing just didn't work. And then later on, yeshiva was closed. They had no choice. Yeshiva was closed. He has. Originally, the alumni of Chaim Berlin printed one volume of collected letters of his that they gathered together. But after they printed the one volume, more people stepped forward and they gave more letters. So they put together, now they have four volumes of collected letters and tshuvas of Rav Chaim Berlin. So he has one of the letters is an important issue. Traditionally, when you write a get, you always write the city where the get is given, and you write the name of the river or the lakes that border the city. Because there's always more than one city with the same name. So in order to identify which city you're talking about, so you say the city borders on this lake and on this river. So the question is, here in Moscow, traditionally they would write Masati Asva, a city that's borders on the Har, I don't know how to pronounce it, Kastrama Reka, something like that. So the word Reka means a river, and it's really Kastrama Reka, the river of Kastrama. So, they used to spell it without any space in between, Kastrama Reka. So the question is, does it make sense to write Masati Asva on the Har, on the river of Kastrama River? You're writing the word river twice. So he suggested they should leave out the word Al-Nahar. He should just write Kastrama Reka. He should write it as two words with the space in between. So this was, he sent this tshuva to Rabbi Yitzchak Petterburger, Rabbi Yitzchak Glazer, who was a rabbi in St. Petersburg. And he wrote to him about the word Burg, Petterburg. The word Burg means city. So usually when you write the name of the city, let's say you write, we're writing to get to New York, Masati Asva Nahar al Nahar Hudson, the river that, the city that borders on the river, on the Hudson River. So you write Masa, the city, but if you write Petterburg, so Peterburg means Peter the city of Peter the Great, So does it make sense to write again Masa? He already wrote the Burg. So he, Chaim Balin, wrote in his tshuva, he doesn't think you should write Masa. He already wrote Petterburg, that already includes the word matzah. He's famous, he has a big issue. I came here on a day before everybody else, so I participated in the brisket. So the moel did mitzitza b'pen. And many say that you're not yotze if you do mitzitza b'kli. So our Chaim Balin has a tshuva where he says you are yotze. It's a double portion that if you do mitzitza b'kli, it's good. But he didn't want to asa mitzitza b'peh, even though it's really, in recent years, they realize that it's very dangerous. You may cause the baby to pick up the infections that the moel may have. So he didn't want to asa it, not to make a whole tumult, but he wrote the tshuva that mitzitza b'kli is certainly kosher. So the mailer, he would recommend that you should do mitzitza b'kli, not b'peh. We were touring in the shul, in the big shul. So the rabbi showed us in the big shul where we daven, when he came, when he first came over 25 years ago, I think. So Rabbi Goldschmidt said that they had men and women davening together in that shul. And the religious Jews that didn't want to daven men and women together, the daven in the room next to the shul. That room is now a separate minyan for Georgian Jews. Many people come to shul just to say Kaddish, so they have the Kaddish transliterated on the left side of the shul in the front in Russian language, and on the right side of the shul they have it transliterated into the Georgian language. So the rabbi told us, Rabbi Goldschmidt told us, that for a while Rav Moshe Feinstein was in Moscow when he wanted to leave, Russia in order to go to America. So he had it. Whoever wanted to leave had to keep on going to the travel agency that was controlled by the government. And that travel agency was in Moscow. So he had to have residence in Moscow for at least 3 months in order to be under the communists, in order to be able to leave. So Moshe left under the communists. And the same thing with Cheskel Abramsky also, when he wanted to leave. So he had to stay in, he had to rent an apartment in Moscow and stay here for over 3 months. And when he went, Cheskel Abramsky, when he went to the travel agency, so they sent them, they put him in jail. Instead of giving him the right to go to leave there, it's Israel, they put him in jail. So Rav Moshe Feinstein had to stay here. So he says he used to give a shiur in that little room where the Frum Yidin used to, he used to daven there. And he used to give a daily shiur in Gemara in the shul. Moshe Feinstein was here under the communists. So under the communists, they closed the mikveh. They didn't allow, in many communities, they didn't allow the Jews to observe the religion. So they closed the mikveh, and they decided, since they had arrangements for water, so they decided they're going to make a swimming pool, and the men and the women should bathe in the swimming pool at the same time, mixed women, in order to remain healthy. Because not everybody had a shower in home. So Moshe Feinstein convinced the one who was doing the work to make the swimming pool in such a way that Bishas Adchak B'di'evin should be a kosher at mikveh. And he insisted his wife should go to the mikveh every month, even though he didn't rely on it. So his wife would not say a bracha, she would go to the mikveh, and they would not live together for several years when they lived under the communists. But since Bishas Adchak, it was a kosher at mikveh, so he told all the other people that they can use the mikveh, they can say a bracha, they're permitted to be with their wives. They have this in the 8th volume of the Igros Moshe, the collection of Rav Moshe's tshuvas. So it starts off with a whole long biography of Rav Moshe. So they write about this. Then he convinced the government, Bitmimus, he convinced the government that the Jews are not very religious. He can't all of a sudden encourage them that they should have men and women bathing together in the same swimming pool at the same time. They have to go a little at a time. So he convinced them that they should have separate hours for the men and separate hours for the women. And after a couple of years, he should convince them that they should swim together. So they had the women used it, still used it as a mikveh. But Rav Moshe was thrilled when he was able to leave Luban. Some of the younger people who got married at that time were wondering whether they're allowed to use the mikveh. But some of them heard that Rav Moshe was machmir. He didn't advertise it. Some of the younger people heard about it. So he told them that those who got married under these circumstances, so they never used a real kosher mikvah l'mahadrin in the first place. But he got married before when the mikvah was kosher l'mahadrin, so that's why he felt that for his wife he felt it was proper to be mahadrin. But for those who got married during the difficult years and the only mikvah available in town with this mikvah that was kosher b'di'evet, so he told him that he doesn't think it's proper that they should be machmir. Under the communists, they didn't. If you would educate your children with Torah, they would send you to jail. It was against the law. So Ramesh's son, Reb David Feinstein, who was born here in Russia, he didn't know alibis. He didn't know how to learn anything at all until he left Russia. Ramesh's brother, Mordechai Feinstein, violated the government laws and he taught his children Torah. They all lost their lives. They were all punished by the communists. But Rav Moshe thought that it would make some more sense to wait till later, not to educate the children with Torah education, to wait till you get freedom. Rav Moshe, when he lived here in Russia, wrote a commentary on the Yerushalmi. When he left Russia, when he came to America, he wasn't able to take that commentary with him. So in his Sfarim, in his Chubas, he bemoans the fact he felt that that was really his life's work. His major work was his commentary on the Yerushalmi. The Chubas, he wrote 1, 2, 3. He didn't have to work so hard to figure out the Chubas, but the commentary on the Yerushalmi, that he felt very bad about. As when the communists took over the country, so they changed the whole monetary system. So it was all Shaila, how much you have to give a pidyon habet. So he had a whole dispute at that time. Rav Moshe Feinstein had a dispute with Rav Yecheskel Abramsky. I don't know exactly what Rav Abramsky said, but Rav Moshe printed his tshuva. He felt upset. He used to complain, even in the late years when he was in America. He was complaining why Rav Yecheskel Abramsky continued to disagree with him, even though the Minsker Gadol agreed with Rav Moshe. So he felt that was the end of the story. What was Rav Yecheskel Abramsky still disagreeing with him? But Cheska Abramsky was a big Talmud Chacham. Cheska Abramsky also lived under the communists. In order to leave the country, he had to keep on going to the passport office, to the travel agency. And that's why he had to move to Moscow at least for 3 months. So Rav. Then Moshe Tzvi Neria was his father. Rav Neria, he was the one who founded all the yeshivot B'nai Akiva. Neria saw the whole network of yeshivot. So his father was also a rabbi here in Russia under the communists. He didn't go under the name Neria. His name was Frumkin or something. I forgot his name. But his father was friendly with Rabbi Cheska Abramsky. So as a teenager, Rav Neria also wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael to learn it. He wanted to leave because they didn't allow you to learn it. They didn't allow you to observe mitzvahs here under the communists. So he was in the passport office, the travel office, I guess, the same time as Rabbi Cheska Abramsky. Abramsky was offered the rabbanis in Petah Tikva, and they said they're going to make a yeshiva, and he's going to be the rabbi in the city. He'll be the Rosh Yeshiva as well. So he thought for sure that he would be given the right to leave Russia to go to Eretz Yisrael. So when he met Moshe Tzvi Neria in the passport office, so he told him he's going to Eretz Yisrael, and if you succeed in getting the right to leave, please come learn in my yeshiva. The end of the story was that Neria, as a teenager, got permission to leave, and Cheska Abramsky was put in jail, and they heard that he wanted to leave. His wife didn't see him after that. He just disappeared. They never gave him his wife was there with him in the passport office, and they just put him in jail. And then they sent him to Siberia. And then all the free nations in the world, the United States and England and all the other free countries, were tumbling. How can the Russian government put this prominent rabbi in prison? Any of the letters, they published a collection of letters from Chaim Heuser about political issues, not in learning. So there's a whole section consisting of many letters of Rav Chaim Heuser, where he's writing to different people that they should see to it that they tumble a lot to free Rabbi Cheska Abramsky from Siberia. He Rishi, because he was already in the middle of writing his commentary on the Tosefta. There were many Rabbanim in jail, but Rabbi Chaim Moshe was more concerned about him than about the other. Very interesting. And then later on, when he was freed, so he went on to London. They created a new position for him that never existed. He wasn't the chief rabbi of England, but he was the head of the Bezin for quite a few years until he retired. Then he moved to Eretz Yisrael. That was the end of his life. And he lived in Beit Vigan. But for many years, his position was he was head of the Bezin in London. Under the communists, the teachers in the public schools would always make fun of the rabbis and tell the children that the rabbis are stupid, the religion doesn't make any sense, and that we're teaching the things that make a lot of sense. So they were telling the children, what does Rav Moshe Feinstein know? He doesn't know how to do mathematics. He doesn't know differential equations. They were making fun of him. So don't listen to what he says about Torah and Shemayim and mitzvahs and everything. So Rav Moshe felt compelled to learn differential equations. So he took out some book from the public library and he mastered it. And the teacher had given some kind of a problem to the students, so he solved the problem. So the people in the goyim, in the community, didn't realize that. He just read the books and he just studied it in order to show the children that the rabbanim are intelligent. So when they had difficult issues in mathematics, they would present it to Rav Moshe. So he had to start reading more books to figure out more mathematics to solve their problems, because they thought that the man is an expert in mathematics. This they have also in the introduction to the 8th volume of the Igros Moshe. In Russia, it was a common thing that in any given city there would be two rabbanim. There would be one rabbi who was a big Talmid Chacham who was chosen by the Jewish community to do the gittin and to paskan the shilas and to supervise the mikveh and the kashrus and everything. And then the rabbi picked by the community didn't necessarily know how to speak Russian, how to write Russian. And the government at that time needed clergymen to record all the births and all the deaths. So the government would appoint a rabbi who knew Russian. So a lot of times the rabbi who was appointed mitam hamemshalah was an Amor, it's Gomer. A lot of times they were not learned at all. They weren't Talmid Chachamim at all. So in Moscow, there was a period of time that the government had appointed most of these Rabbanim. They were known historically as Rabbanim, the Rab Mitam. It means the Rab Mitam HaMemshala. He was appointed by the government, not necessarily a Talmid Chacham. There were less than 10 of them, I think, Sach HaKol, who really knew how to learn. So one of them, who was a rabbi in Moscow for quite a while, he was appointed rabbi 1893 or something like that, was Rabbi Yankov Maza. That's a famous name. Maza is a Rosh Tevis Mizera Aharon HaKohen. Kohanim sometimes had the name Maza. There was a Rabbi Maza here on the east side, also a relative. He wasn't a descendant of this Rabbi Yankov Maza. He was a relative of his. I think they say Jackie Mason's original name was Maza, and Mason sounded better, so he changed it to Jackie Mason, the comedian. So this Rav Yankov Maza, happens that he went to university, and then he went to law school, and he had a law degree. And the government appointed him, thinking that he's a secular man. He knew in Russian, he went to university. Happened that he was a Talmid Chacham. So when they had in 1911, something like that, the parliament was considering doing away with the regulation that they had, that they restricted where the Jews were allowed to live. They had the Pale of Settlement. The Jews couldn't live in certain areas, in many areas in Russia. So the parliament was considering the possibility of changing the laws. The Jews are nice people, maybe we can get along with them. So at that time, they made up a whole case against Mendel Bilas, who was a religious Jew, a whole blood libel. So they had a whole court case. They found a Christian church. child was murdered. The end of the story was, after a couple of years, the murderers admitted that they did. It was a bunch of gangsters. But they had false witnesses testifying that this Mendel Bilas was the one who killed them in order to use the blood to bake matzahs. This was the blood libel that came up every couple of years in Chutz Lords. So they had to have someone, they had to have a lawyer defend the Jewish religion, defend the Jewish people. It wasn't just a blood libel against Mendel Bilas, it was against all Jewish people. So many of the rabbanim, the chassidish rabbis, they all said that this Yankov Maza, the rabbi in Moscow, he was a lawyer, he had a law degree. They said he should be the one to defend the Jewish people and the Jewish religion. So there was a whole case that went on in court for over 30 days. And they had the witnesses testify. Everything fell apart. The whole case was ridiculous. They wrote it up. Quite a few books were written about the whole Mendel Bilas process, about the whole case in court. And then they write up that this Rabbi Maza spoke defending the Jewish people. He spoke over 8 hours in court on one day. He spoke for 4 hours. Then there was a break, a coffee break in the middle, or for lunch, whatever. And then he spoke for another over 4 hours. He said he was he defended the Jewish people. He explained that the whole thing was ridiculous. And acharei kechlos hakol, after the 8 hours of presentation about what Jewish values are, what Jewish religion is all about, so the jury was split. There were 6 who said guilty and 6 who said innocent. So because it was 6 against 6, so they couldn't, they can't give the divorces. So if the fashas lahakel, but there were 6 who said that he's still guilty after all that. And then it slept on. The whole case was over in a little over a month. But the whole issue kept on repeating itself. The whole reason why they built up the whole case against him was that they didn't want the parliament to change the law. They wanted that the Jewish people should not have the right to live in normal Russia. The place where we had lunch yesterday, the yeshiva, the name of the yeshiva, originally the name of yeshiva was Kol Yaakov, and then when the yeshiva was founded a long time ago, in the rabbi in Moscow, in 1956, I think, wanted to found a yeshiva, Kol Yaakov, named after Rabbi Yankov Maza, and then he invited this Rabbi Levin, Rabbi Yehuda Leib Levin, who was a big Talmud Chacham. He had learned in Slabodki Yeshiva when Rav Baruch Be'er was the Rosh Yeshiva there. Rav Baruch Be'er was Rosh Yeshiva in different yeshivas at different times. So in Slabodki there were 2 yeshivas. There was a Knesset Beis Yitzchak, named after Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan, and Knesset Yisrael, named after Rabbi Saul Salanter. So the Knesset Yisrael was the Musa Yeshiva, and the Knesset Beis Yitzchak, named after Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan, was the anti-Musa Yeshiva. And Rav Baruch Be'er was the head of the anti-Musa yeshiva. He was the head of the... He was Rosh Yeshiva Knesset Beis Yitzchak. So this Rabbi Levin, whom I remember he was the chief rabbi of Moscow. He died something like 1975, I think. So he visited America the year after Mechemet Sheshet Hayamim. So I remember they had... Dr. Belkin was then the president of the yeshiva. So he had a mesiba in his honor in the cafeteria. So all the students attended. They encouraged all the students to come. And then Dr. Belkin told Rabbi Levin, go back, he spoke in Yiddish, so go back to Russia and tell the Jews in Russia that you saw the biggest Russian yeshiva in the world, the whole wide world. And this yeshiva that has so many students in it, Yeshiva Yitzchak Hanan, was founded with the nickels and the dimes of the Russian peddlers. On the Lower East Side, they collected all the money, and they named it after Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan. He had a big influence on the Jews in Russia. He worked very hard to try to make Shmiras HaMitzvahs among the Russian Jews. So this Rabbi Levin was invited by the rabbi of Moscow at that time. I think the name was Rabbi Schleifer, if I'm not mistaken. So he invited Rabbi Levin to be the Rosh Yeshiva of the Yeshiva's Kol Yaakov. The rabbi of Moscow passed away. So then there are many candidates for the rabbanis in Moscow. So and the government had to approve who should be appointed, and they found a psul with all of the candidates. The only one who didn't, they didn't find a psul was this Rabbi Levin. So he was appointed the rabbi of Moscow. So Nebuch, when he came to visit in America, everything was controlled by the communists, tightly controlled by the communists at that time. So he came with the chazan of his community. And the chazan was obviously, everyone realized the chazan represented the government, represented the KGB. So he couldn't say anything, couldn't say a word against the government. So when he would say how life is in Russia, everything is wonderful, and Shmiras HaMitzvahs and freedom of religion, everybody knew that it wasn't true. But he had to say that because the Shamas was there. So this yeshiva, Kol Yaakov, the yeshiva that originally this Rabbi Levin was invited to come to Moscow to head the yeshiva, and then the rabbi in Moscow, Rabbi Schleifer, had passed away, and they made Rabbi Levin the chief rabbi of Moscow with the yeshiva. So the yeshiva was originally named after this Maza. His name was Rabbi Yankov Maza. There are streets in different cities in Eretz Yisrael named after Rehov Maza. Every city has, because he was a big Zionist. So this, and now the yeshiva is called Ohla Yaakov. They changed it from Kol Yaakov to Ohla Yaakov. For many years, we never had anything written by this Rabbi Levin. So just 6 years ago, he has a granddaughter who is obviously a Lubavitcher who lives in Crown Heights. So she put together a biography of her grandfather, about 20-page biography. And the name of the book is Leib Yehuda, because the father's name was Yehuda Leib. And it has Divrei Torah, about 150 pages of Divrei Torah written by the grandfather. Most of the Divrei Torah is all about smicha. About smicha bizman hazeh, which is only an imitation smicha. And the issue in the 1500s, when they wanted to reinstitute the smicha in Tzfat, during the lifetime of Rabbi Yosef Karo, and they gave Rabbi Yosef Karo smicha, and they gave a few, around three or four people got smicha, then a couple of years later, another five people got smicha, then the whole project fell apart. So the Rabbi Leib Ibn Chabib was the rabbi in Yerushalayim at that time. He was opposed to the whole reinstitution of smicha. So this Rabbi Leib 11, all of them Mamarim are all about this reinstituting the smicha. It's interesting, he writes like a Talmud Chacham. It's very nice. The Gemaras and Rambams and Yerushalmis, he writes with a nice, beautiful style. It's interesting. There's a famous interpretation in the Gemara that's said over in the name of this Rabbi Maza, that the Gemara has a Machlekes Atanoim, whether a Nochri who dies is Metame Ba'ohel. We assume a maize, a human body is maize, is matame b'mago u'b'masa. If you touch the body with the hands, if you're wearing gloves, then there's no maga, but if you move the body, then it's masa. And not only maga masa, it's matame b'ohel. So the Gemara has a machlekes satanaim, where they may say akum. And nochish a maize is matame b'ohel. And there's a machlekes halacha l'maisa, out of paskin. So the ikar of psak seems to be like the Rambam, that may say akum, and not matame b'ohel. Like the opinion of the Tana Rav Shimon Vayichoy. This is based on the Pasuk in Parshas Chukas, going to lay in a couple of weeks, that it says, Adam ki amas ba'ohel. That the Nes is matami ba'ohel. So Rav Shimon Vayichoy says, Atem kriyim Adam, ve'ein hu masalim kriyim Adam. So this Maimer Chazal, this din, caused a lot of aggravation to the Jewish people for many years. As if we don't consider the Umas Olam as Bnei Adam, what kind of a Loshan is that? So this Rabbi Maza is famous for his interpretation of that Gemara. He says that different ways in the Hebrew language, the different words that refer to a human being, so you have Ish, Gever, and Adam. So ish has a singular and a plural. You say ish is singular and anashim is plural. You have gever is a person, gvarim means a few people. Then you have adam is the singular and adam is the plural. It's the same word for the singular and the plural. So he said what it means is atem kruim adam, by the Jewish people, the whole klal yisrael is one tziruf together. By the Ummah Sa'ilam, there is no concept of a tziruf atzibur. That's what the Gemara says. Each nochri is an independent person. The idea of a klal, of a kohol, only applies by Bnei Yisrael. So by the Ummah Sa'ilam, you have, there's a gever and there's gvarim. There's a singular and there's a plural. There's ish and anashim. An osh and anashim also, the singular and plural. There are four different words. Ish, enosh, gever, and adam. And by Bnei Yisrael, it's adam. The singular and the plural is all the same thing. The Ummah Sa'ilam, they look at if one Jew does an avera, so they say all the Jews are going off, all the Jews are rapists, all the Jews are this, they all do, they all cheat on income tax. By Ummah Sa'ilam, they wouldn't say like that. If one Chinaman does an avera, one Frenchman does an avera, you don't say all the French are cheaters, all the French are going off. You don't say like that. And it's correct, there's taka difference, because by the Ummah Sa'ilam, there's not zero of one person with the other, but by Klal Yisrael, it's one big Ummah Israelis. So this was brought out by a long 8-hour speech that he gave in court defending the Jewish people. He mentioned that. He said that he got a letter from Rabbi Meir Shapiro, who lived in Lublin. He was the one who founded the Lublin Yeshiva, that he should fight out the case properly in court. So he said, in any other trial, would it make sense that someone from one country would send a letter to someone in another country? Lublin is in Poland, so what does he send a letter to? The court case, I think, the trial, I think, was in Kiev. Why did he send a letter to Kiev to fight out the case properly? The answer is, all the Klal Yisrael, wherever they live, all over the world, there's one tziruf, one Ummah Yisraelis. In Ummah Sa'ilam, there is no such thing. There's no shaychus between a person in one country, a person in another country. This is one of the famous comments that he made. By Yaakov Maza, was a Yosem at a very young age. Both parents passed away. He was raised by the grandparents. But his parents had a mixed marriage. The father was from Hasidic background. The mother was from Misnagdim. So when he became Bar Mitzvah, both parents were no longer alive. So he got a matone from one of the mother's side of the family, from the Misnagdish side of the family. Somebody gave him a Mishnayis with a commentary of the Vilna Goin. And they showed him on the day of his Bar Mitzvah, they showed him, look in the Vilna Goin's commentary on a Mishnah in the end of Bava Kama, what a marvelous pshat he gives on the Mishnah. That it says if a person stole money from someone else and he swore falsely, that he doesn't owe the money, so the halacha says, Yalechen Acharav, Afidu Lamadai, even if he lives far away, in Madai you have to spend a fortune of money to return the money that you stole and you swore falsely. And you have to bring a carbon to the Beis HaMikdash Hashem Zeil. So why does it Afidu Lamadai? So we usually learn Lamadai means even if it's Merchakim, even if it's very far away, it's going to cost you a fortune of money to give the money back to him. So the Vilna Gaon tells you, look in a certain pasuk in Yeshayah. He doesn't tell you what he means. So the relative who gave him the Mishnayis showed him, this is what he writes in his memoirs. He has four volumes of memoirs. So the relative showed him, the Vilna Gaon says, look in the pasuk in Yeshayah. So he showed him, look in the pasuk. Pasuk says that in the city, if you want to say that something is very far away, so you say even Baspamya, you don't say Afilu Madai. The pasuk in Yeshayah says that in the city Madai, Kesef Zohav was meaningless. The people were so rich, the gold and silver, it didn't mean anything. So the Vilna Gaon says, Yalchen Acharav Afilu Madai means, even though the Kesef that you stole is worth is peanuts, it doesn't mean anything. The people were so rich there, still you have to give them back the money, even though it's insignificant. Not that even though it's very far away, it's going to cost a lot of money. The din is true, but the Vilna Gaon thought that that's not what it means. So then he writes in his memoirs that somebody from his father's side of the family, they were the Hasidim, gave him a Hasidish Siddur with all the commentary. And they pointed out to him on the Shabbos of his Bar Mitzvah that by the Hasidim, when they daven Mincha on Friday afternoon, they say a Perek in Tehillim, praising HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hodu Lashem, they say Hodu, and they say Yomer no Guhuli Hashem. Those who are redeemed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu should say. And those who are why do we say that? Why do they have the minhag to say that before Mincha? So the Pashto says the Guhuli Hashem, Adabot Zichem LaHodu, speaks about the Yordei Hayam and the people who are Bistakona and so on. What has it got to do with saying that Friday afternoon? So in this Hasidish Siddur, they explain something about there's another Geula. There's a Geula Saguf and there's a Geula Sanefesh. When Shabbos comes, it's the Geula Sanefesh, the Neshamas are not burning in Gehenna. And all of us, the living people, have a Geula on Shabbos. It's a different style of living. So he was influenced both by the Hasidish half of his relatives and by the Misnagdish half. And he always said, Derech Eretz for the Biuri Hagro. Thought just as a bar mitzvah book on the day of his bar mitzvah, they pointed out to him the way the Vilna Gaon gives Hoshe Pshat in Gemara is based on Tanakh. He thought that was fantastic. And the Chen Achra, Afil Lola Moda, is based on a Pasuk in Yeshaya. So he always thought that the Vilna Gaon always gives the most direct Hoshe Pshat in all the Gemaras from the day of his bar mitzvah.
Yes. Okay.
While we were in Moscow, we didn't have too much of a chance to talk about the Rabbanim there. So I'd like to say a few additional words. This Rabbi Yaakov Maza, I mentioned, was an orphan at a very young age. Both parents died, so he was raised by the grandparents. So he writes in his memoirs that his grandparents had a dispute whether they should allow him to go to the secular high school. So the grandmother said no, because you have to dress like the Nochrim, and he'll become a Goy Gomer. And the grandfather said no, he's a frum boy, it's okay, and it's important, he should learn Russian, he should be able to be a good speaker, a public speaker. And the grandmother was afraid he'll become a Goy Gomer. So they went to the Malbim, because at that time they lived in the city where the Malbim was the rabbi. Now the Malbim was a rabbi in many different cities. About 25 years ago, they discovered archives of different communities, and they found out why the Malbim always lost his positions. Apparently his wife was a character. His wife came from a wealthy family, and she would always bring her jewelry to the pawn shop in order to get money, in order to buy other jewelry, and every city he lost his position because of his wife. Sometimes because of the maskilim, because he was fighting with the maskilim, most of the time because of his wife. Anyway, so at that time, the grandparents lived in the same city with the Malbim, so they brought this dispute to the Malbim. So the Malbim said, who, that little boy, the one who pays attention to my drushes all the time, you don't have to worry about him. He's a tzaddik, he understands emunah as a young child. And he said he can go to Goyisha High School and he's not going to fall in. So he went to the Goyisha High School. He dressed like the Goyim, but he was a Shema Mitzvah, and he picked up Russian. He knew how to speak Russian very well. And then when he was in public high school, one day the Tsar's wife passed away. He writes in his memoirs, it was the wife of, Alexander II, or something like that. And there was a special assembly in the school in honor of the Tsar's wife who passed away, and they said, Hespedim. And then the principal of the school said, and now in respect for Yoshke, we should all bow down. So all the students in the school bowed down, except for this kid. What do you mean? You're not allowed to bow down for Yoshke, it's Yoharik Val Yaver. So they were the school was very upset. And they called him in the next day into the principal's office, and they asked him, how you talking? How come he disrupted the assembly by not bowing down? He said, didn't disrupt anything. There's freedom of religion, and he's not allowed to worship another religion. So they sent him home. They dismissed him for a week, and they said they're going to have to discuss it. So the consultant for Jewish religious affairs was a rabbi in that city. It wasn't the Malbim. It was one of the rabbis who was appointed by the Russian government, the Rabbanim Mitam, as they were known, Mitam HaMem Shalah, who was not learned at all. So the rabbi said, no, out of respect for the other religion, all the Jews should bow down to Yoshke.
Everyone was supposed to bow down. So they kicked the student out of school. So the grandfather said he's going to send a complaint to the Board of Education. So he wrote a long letter explaining how brilliant his grandchild is, and he does so well. All of his grades are so good, and he's a top student in the school. How can they kick him out? And the real rabbis say, you're not allowed to bow down to Yoshke. How are you talking? This is ridiculous. So the minister of education, the one in charge of the whole region, overrode the decision of the Board of Education of the school, and they took him back into the school. He was a star student. So that's why from high school on, he was accepted into university, and then he went to law school, and then he became a lawyer. And then, because he was so brilliant and so outstanding, and he spoke Russian very well, so he was appointed by the government as the Rav Mitam. He was the government rabbi. Most of the government appointees, most of the rabbis appointed by the Goyish government in the cities in Russia were Amaratzim Gimurim. And this Rabbi Maza was an exception to the rule. There may be less than 10 of the Rabbanim Mitam who knew how to learn, knew something about Yiddishkeit. This Rabbi Maza used to joke about the fact that he used to tell over the story that there was once a bris, and the local Rabbi Mitam wasn't able to attend the bris. So he sees the father of the child on Shabbos, and he asked him, what did you name the baby by the bris? They said, he named the baby Don. That's the name of one of the Yud Beshvatim, Don. So apparently there's a Don River in Russia. I don't know what it corresponds to. So the rabbi didn't even know that Don is a Jewish name from the Chumash. So he said, oh, you named your son after the river. Maybe next time you have another boy, you name the next boy after the other river in Russia. So this Rabbi Maza used to tell over that story. And he was the one, this Rabbi Maza, because he was such a good public speaker, and because he was he had a law degree, and he was a lawyer before he became a rabbi. He was the one that all the rabbanim said he should be the lawyer to defend the Jewish people and the Talmud in the Bailus process, when they had the whole Alilas Adam, the blood libel against Mendel Bailus, and they claimed that he killed a Christian child in order to use the blood to bake the matzahs. So he was the one who spoke that we spoke about. He spoke for over 8 hours in court. Spoke for 4 hours, then they had a coffee break for a while, then he continued to speak to defend the Jewish people. One of the other prominent rabbis who was the rabbi in that Koral Shul in Moscow that we visited on Shabbos morning was Rabbi Yaakov Klemus. He apparently was a big Talmud Chacham. He was he left Eretz Yisrael in the 1930s. Then he died, I think, in the 1940s, before Hakamas HaMedina. He died, but he was there while Rav Kook was still alive. He came. Rav Kook died, I think, 1935, if I'm not mistaken. And Rav Klemus came there in the early 1930s. And he, right away, he was under Rav Herzog. He was accepted as a member of the Rabbanut. And there was a big issue where he had a big dispute with all of the other Rabbanim. There was a man who lived there in Uzbekistan or something, who wanted to divorce his wife who lived in Eretz Yisrael. So they sent a get in the mail. You can't send a get in the mail because you have to have an esinah. So the husband appointed a shaliach to give the get to his wife. He appointed the shaliach biksav. So that's already a question. When the husband appoints a shliach to give a get to his wife, does he have to appoint a shliach in person, or can even appoint shaloi b'fonav? So we usually machmen, but if it's a big shas hadchak v'nekel. Okay, so that all the rabbanim were prepared to agree on. But then another issue was that the get was written not in Hebrew, not in Aramaic. The get is usually written in Hebrew Aramaic. Here it was written in some other language. And then it was written so that is questionable, so there's room to be made over there also. Okay. And then the Shaila was, it wasn't written in Ksav Ashuris, it wasn't written in block letters of Aleph Beis, it was written in Ksav Rashi. So that's also questionable. The halacha recognizes all spoken languages. Let's say a person wants to recite Kriya Shema in translation, so there's a dispute in the Mishnah whether one is in fulfillment of the mitzvah. We paskin, you can recite Kriya Shema in translation. It has to be a literal translation. You can't just say We have a mitzvah to like Tfilin Shal Yadin, Tfilin Shal Rosh, and we have a mitzvah to love HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You have to have a literal translation of every pasuk. Fine. So you can recite Kriya Shema in English and French and Spanish and German, even though it's not from the Shivim Lashon in the days of Migdal Bodol. There was such a suggestion. One of the Gedolim, Rabbi Chaim Zalman Margolius, had such a suggestion. When the Reform started davening in German, so many Gedolim were very opposed. All the Gedolim were opposed, Rabbi Kiveger and Sam Sefer, and all the Rabbanim. So the Rabbi Chaim Zalman Margolius wrote a whole tshuva why he was opposed. So one of the reasons was he thought that true, one can fulfill the mitzvah of davening and reciting Kriya Shema in translation in other languages, but only one of the 70 official languages that existed in the days of Migdal Bavel. So who can tell us for sure that German, most probably the spoken German in the middle 1800s, the early 1800s, was probably not one of the Shivim Loshans. Probably, definitely not, right? So we don't really hold like that. We hold that the question is how great a population has to speak a language. Let's say five friends get together and they make up their own Pig Latin, they make up their own language. Is that recognized as a spoken language and they can yotze zayin kriya shma davening in that language, or is it just like singing a niggun? How many people have to speak the language that it should be recognized as a language? That's a shaila. Rabdavala Soloveitchik raises that shaila in the shiur in the first daf in Gazir, and it's unclear what the answer is. So although the halacha recognizes really all spoken languages, if it's within reason that you have a whole city or a whole country that speaks that language, the question is written languages. Maybe the halacha, there is an opinion in the Rishonim that's quoted in Hilcha Shabbos. The halacha only recognizes two written languages, Ksav Ashuris, alphabets in other words. The halacha only recognizes Ksav Ashuris, block letters, and Ksav Yevanis. The Mishnah Gittin talks about a get that was written in Greek and signed in Hebrew, block letters. Are written in Hebrew block letters and signed in Greek. So some Rishonim, very small group of Rishonim, a tiny, tiny group of Rishonim, there were hundreds of Rishonim, this is three or four maximum, came up with this Einfall that Allah only recognizes these two scripts, the script of Greek and the script of the block letters of Aleph. Allah would not recognize Rashi Ksav. But that also we probably don't say. Over here, the get was written transliteration. It was written in a different language, not in Hebrew, and it was written in Rashi script. So that the other Rabbanim would also be meikel on that. But there were other issues over here. The get in the Rif, when the Rif quotes the text of the get, what it's supposed to say. So let's say, for example, Aksuba. Aksuba says, we, the undersigned, testify that Ech Shah Bachar, that so and so proposed to the girl, and he said Harayat Mukadeshusly, and he obligated himself in the Ksuba and so on. So it always says Ech. We, the undersigned, testify that. So the Rif writes the same text by a get, that the get is signed by witnesses. So they sign. They say we, the undersigned, testify that the husband is divorcing his wife. So many Rishonim say that that's a mistake. It's a Torah Sefer in the Rif. The get has to be written b'loshen noichach. Shouldn't be written b'loshen edim. Has to be written b'loshen habal. I am divorcing you. Areat mugresh is mimeni. You shouldn't say the word eich. We, the underside, testify that. The edim have to sign on the bottom. But the text of the get should be b'loshen habal. So here, the get was not written b'loshen habal. It wasn't. It was written, instead of writing, you will now be allowed to remarry, said, and my wife will now be permitted to remarry. So Rabbi Kleiman said, that's not Miyaka Vidyevin, even though it's not written Meloshin Neuchach, it's written Meloshin Nista, it's not written that you will be allowed, it says, my wife will be allowed to remarry. That was okay. Then there was another issue. There was no Talmid Chacham who was Masada to get. So usually there is a discussion, a big debate, and Rishonim, they have to write something lishma. A get has to be written lishma. When you tie tzitzis, there's a weir machmer for the opinion that you have to tie the tzitzis on the beged lishma. You have to write a sefer Torah, tefillin, and mezuzah lishma. So there's a big dispute in the Rishonim whether lishma is enough. If you think in your mind, you have to say the pe. Harini kosev getzel lishma lishma l'shem gerishin. So we are usually machmer on that. So here, the one who organized the whole thing was not a Talmid Chacham. He most probably did not have the sefer write the whole thing. He had it written. The Shema was clearly for the purpose of divorcing the wife, but he probably didn't say b'peh. So Rabbi Klemus, this Rabbi Yankov Klemus, who retired already to Eretz Yisrael, the early 1930s, this Maisa B'Diged was Tavshin Aleph, Shnas Tavshin Aleph. And he died soon after, a couple of years after, he died before HaKomis HaMedina, something like 1945. So he thought that he could be Mekal on that. And most of the Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael at that time, the get was sent from somewhere in Uzbekistan or something to Eretz Yisrael to be taken care of. And he picked out a shliach to serve as the shliach to give the get. So this Rav Yankov Klemus felt he could be Mekal. And the Chazon Ish had a correspondence back and forth with him, around five or six letters back and forth to each other. Each time they wrote around 10 or 12 letters back and forth. And each time the Chazon Ish insisted, you can't just ignore, the tradition has it that we're makbid on this and we're makbid on that. You can't just ignore everything. Then the Chazon Ish said, it has to say, Hariat Mugureshes Mimeni. I say, I'm hereby divorcing you, Mikan al Habo. Has to say, I'm hereby divorcing you with this get. It didn't say that, Hariat Mugureshes Mimeni. Even in the translation, it didn't say. So Rabbi thought that all of this was just lachatchila. So they wrote to each other with great respect. As Rabbi Klemus writes about Hagoyen HaMefursim HaChazon Ish, Balam HaBesifrei HaChazon Ish, the Chazon Ish writes to him also with big respect. But he disagrees. Each one is very forceful in his opinion. Rav Klemus felt that it's a big shasatrak. The woman will be an aguna for the rest of her life. If you're going to say the get is no good, they're not going to get another get. And the Chazon Ish held that even shasatrak, it's not really right to be mekum. There was a... yesterday, Svatlana was explaining to us in the art museum that under the communists, they controlled everything, even art. How you have to paint paintings. The government had their say about how to paint paintings. So the government had their say that they controlled under the communists. There was no freedom of investigation. There was no freedom of expression. You couldn't print whatever you wanted to. So it's interesting. About 10 years ago, there was a long article in the New York Times. And now that communism collapsed, now the historians finally publicized all the information that they found out about the Kuzarim. Yehuda Halevi wrote a book that's called Sefer HaKuzari. There was a country where the king, the story goes that the king had a recurrent dream that Yehuda Halevi was a student of the Rif. That was before the days of Rashi and Tosfos. Long, long, long time ago, 1,000 years ago. So Rabbi Yehuda Halevi writes over the story that the king had a recurrent dream, that his intentions are very noble, that he wants to worship God, but he's worshiping the wrong religion. So because the dream was repeated several times, so he felt he has to look into the other religions. So first he only looked into Christianity and Islam. He didn't think that Judaism could possibly be the true religion because the Jews were so stepped upon, they were so downtrodden. And then finally, after he heard from the Christian representative and the Muslim representative, they said that their religions are based on the Jewish religion. They realized has to listen to what the rabbi has to say. So he invited the rabbi, and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi writes a whole historical novel, what the conversation was probably like. So the end of the story was, we don't know how much of this story is an agoda, and how much of the story is true, but part of the story is true. That the king converted, and many of the members of his cabinet converted. Then he got many of the members of the community to convert. There was a big area in Russia. This was in Russia. There was a large area in Russia that was controlled by Jewish people. The area of the Kuzarim. So under the communists, they didn't allow publication of the research into the Kuzarim. The research was done by Nochrim. It wasn't done by Jews. They didn't allow publication. They didn't want anybody to know that there was a period of time that the Jews were in control of the government in a big area in Russia. So after communism collapsed, then they finally, there was a little more freedom, a lot more freedom. So they published what they discovered. that these Kuzarim, they Taka were Jewish, and they did have control. They weren't that observant, but they were Jewish. They didn't know too much about Shmiras HaMitzvos. Same thing is true. The communist government didn't allow freedom of research into science either. The communists, on principle, didn't believe in God. So this posed a problem that Louis Pasteur had proved that there's no such thing as spontaneous generation, that life cannot come from anything other than life. Only living beings can give birth to living beings. So how did the original life come into existence if there's no such thing as spontaneous generation? So you have to believe in God. But the communists were atheists, Peshitta. They didn't believe in God. So they commissioned their scientists to disprove, they paid the money, that they should disprove Louis Pasteur, that there is such a thing as spontaneous generation. So mainly you don't have to have any God to bring life into the world. They were controlling science, they were controlling art, they were controlling everything. That's why they didn't allow any religious observance.
That's why.